They Were Afraid, an Easter sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
For to proclaim the resurrection of Jesus, an empty tomb, is not good news, not for sinners, apart from his death for sinners.
And we'll send you a CD of this sermon and an Ascension sermon for any size gift during the 50 days of Easter. Make a secure online donation today, issuesetc.org. Thanks for your support during the Easter season.
We have gathered in Tampa from many countries around the world. This is quite a moment in the story of United Methodism.
The overseas, chiefly the Africans, will become a majority of the denomination within 10 years or less. And with that, it's almost impossible for the liberal side of the church to prevail.
There comes a time when all of us are going to face some of the limitations that come with age, and we're a youth-obsessed society that really doesn't know how to deal, first of all, with death, and secondly, with aging in a graceful way.
I think it's great to expose our kids, to expose the church to that. And I think for far too long, the church has sort of stifled creativity.
I think Ed Young has a way of getting his point across without live animals as props, as entertainment.
Thank you for providing theology for clerical collar, white collar, and blue collar.
Well, we come to the end of our series on biblical archaeology. I don't think it was ever designed to be this way, but we're going to be talking about what met many people at their end in first century Palestine, a tomb, perhaps if you were wealthy enough, a burial box for your bones. We're going to talk about those bones, some crucifixion victims, and the tombs themselves, along with the Jewish burial traditions, here in part five of our daily series on biblical archaeology with Dr. Craig Evans. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. You can join us for the next hour. We do invite your questions and comments on this subject, and more generally, because we're ending our series on biblical archaeology, 1-877-623-6943, coming to you live this Friday afternoon, April the 27th, 1-877-623-6943. You can send us an email with a question or a comment, talkback@issuesetc.org, or you can go to our Facebook fan page and leave a question or a comment there. Facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Craig Evans is Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada, and he's author of several books, including his latest publication titled Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. Dr. Evans, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Let's jump right in. In fact, it dovetails beautifully with something we were talking about yesterday. We were talking about the ruling priests and a lot of the evidence surrounding the families of Annas and Caiaphas were found in their tombs, in their ossuaries, their bone boxes. And this is something that allows us to date burials, at least to begin to date certain burials, because it's, I take it, kind of an unmistakable change in Jewish burial practice, at least for the wealthy, right around the time of Jesus. Why does it change then?
Yes, that's right. But I need to qualify, there were changes, but in other ways it was a continuation of a much older practice. So let me, if I may, just back up a little bit. The idea of secondary burial or reburial is a very old tradition in the ancient Near East. And so what happens is the person died, there was a funeral, the body was laid to rest, and then subsequently, later it became a tradition of 12 months later, the bones were gathered up. And what typically happened, the bones were either gathered and placed in a niche. Sometimes it was a common little burial spot within the tomb where the bones of all the family were gathered. But what happened, the reason, what you're asking about, was a noticeable change in the time of Jesus, and it was brought about, I think most archaeologists believe, because of Herod's building program. And Herod became king in reality in 37 BC when he defeated a rival with Rome's help. And so not long after that, he began a very ambitious rebuilding of Jerusalem that centered on the Temple Mount and the various buildings, including the sanctuary that stood there. And what happened was thousands of stone cutters were employed, and they began to quarry large limestone blocks. And limestone, if you know much about it, can be marbled. It can be very defective in places. And so there were many rejected stones. And these rejected stones then could be used for other purposes. And one of the purposes was carving them into these bone boxes called ossuaries. A bone box, I do a little dance sometimes for an audience, and I'm standing on the stage, and I lift up my leg, and I say, it's the length of the femur, that's the longest bone in your upper leg, it's the width of your hips, and then I tip over, and I say, and I grab my rib cage, it's the depth of the rib cage. In other words, a bone box is just large enough to contain a disarticulated human skeleton. Well, that's what an ossuary is. And the custom of making lots of ossuaries out of limestone, and they had a very similar pattern and designs, you're right, that began in the 30s, 20s and 30s B.C. It also had to do with the growth of Jerusalem, high-density population. I mean, it just wasn't economical or feasible to have huge tombs. And so a regular-sized tomb could contain 60, 70, 80 relatives if their bones were gathered up and placed in these more or less small boxes. So that's what was going on, and it became very commonplace in Jesus' time. It was a custom everybody knew. Archaeologists, of course, benefit from it because we find bones that we can, you know, we can measure, we can study, we find names inscribed on these boxes, and so that helps us in various ways also.
Okay, so what would have been, you mentioned it in kind of broad outline, and we have a bit of this in the New Testament. There are several accounts of funerals. We got Lazarus's burial, we got the widow's son at Nain, we have, of course, Christ's burial as well, but what in particular would have happened upon the death of a loved one in a devout Jewish society in first century Palestine?
Well, we know surprisingly exactly, actually, what happens because it's spelled out in Jewish sources, and we also see some stories in the book of Acts and also in the Gospels. And so here's what happens. When a person died, the person was prepared for burial and buried that very day, unless their death took place at the end of day or at night, in which case the body then was prepared for burial and remained in the house until the next morning. Preparation for burial was very simple. The body was washed. It was then wrapped. It was perfumed. That was all. The body was not embalmed, and so the Jewish people did not do what Egyptians did. And there very rarely was a sarcophagus. Sometimes there might be a sarcophagus. There was one, we think, for King Herod and for other very, very exalted persons. But for most people, the body was simply wrapped, washed, wrapped, perfumed, and then carried out of the village to the burial ground and usually placed in a cave. It might be something a bit more ornate, carved out, and laid on a ledge inside the burial cave. And then a stone was placed over the opening. And then the funeral lasted for 7 days, right there at the grave, sometimes inside the tomb itself. And we can see how sometimes the floors in the tombs, a certain place would be dished out a little lower so that a person could stand upright and not be stooped over. Remember, the Jewish people prayed standing upright with their heads looking up toward heaven and their hands reaching up. And then after 7 days of graveside mourning, weeping, lamentation, musical instruments being played, scriptures being read, prayers being said, the funeral was over. 12 months later, the family gathered and at the tomb, and the bones of the deceased were gathered up. Now, by the way, this is limestone, and most of this ground in and around Jerusalem. And so limestone causes desiccation to take place very quickly. So the corpse would long since be desiccated, and all that would be left would be bones. The bones would be gathered up and then placed in a bone box. Sometimes the person's name would then be inscribed on the bone box, and that's what's so helpful for us. So it might say Joseph, son of, you know, Jacob, or something like that inscribed on the box. Very helpful. Sometimes there'd be reference made to the kind of work he did. Sometimes a nickname would be provided. Sometimes two or more names would be inscribed on a box, because we often find two or more skeletons in the box. And so that was the Jewish burial practice. It was different, though, if it was a criminal. If a criminal was executed, his body would be taken down from the cross or taken off the tree, the gibbet, or whatever, and would be placed in a tomb that was required, of course. No body was left lying outside exposed overnight, but the tomb would be a tomb reserved for criminals, a place of dishonor. Then, after 12 months, the family could gather the bones if they wanted to, and the bones could then be relocated to a place of honor, which usually meant the family tomb. So that was the Jewish burial practice observed in the time of Jesus, a generation or two before and a generation or two after.
And they believed, I mean, part of the kind of the popular piety of this was they believed that the spirit of the soul of the deceased individual lingered with the corpse for a certain amount of time, didn't they?
Yes, that's right. We actually have written statements from early Jewish sources saying that the soul lingered near the body for 3 days. Why 3 days? Well, the tradition was based on the idea that on the fourth day, the face changed. And so for 3 days, the face of the deceased could be recognized. The soul could recognize it, stayed near, sort of caught betwixt and between this world and the next. But when the face changed, the soul would depart. And I think that does lend some clarity to the story of Lazarus. And remember one of the sisters remarks tearfully to Jesus that Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. And her point is, it's hopeless now. His spirit is gone. His body has begun to decay. It doesn't smell very good. And, of course, Jesus' point is in raising Lazarus on the fourth day, it justifies his extraordinary claim that he really is the resurrection and the life.
We're talking with Dr. Craig Evans. It's part five of our daily series with him this week on biblical archaeology. Today we're talking about Jewish burial traditions. I invite your questions and comments, 1-877-623-MYIE. We are coming to you live, 1-877-623-6943. Or leave a question or a comment at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesETC.
If your travels bring you to Northwest Indiana, the Saints of Heritage Lutheran Church in Valparaiso invite you to join us for a Christ-centered, cross-focused divine service at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning. For more information about visiting Heritage, please contact Pastor Joseph Ostafinski by calling 219-464-2810 or sending an email to heritagelc@frontier.com. You can also visit us on the web at www.heritage-lcms.org.
Imagine steadfastlutherans.org as the internet version of your neighborhood pub, your neighborhood confessional Lutheran pub, that is, where the finest in Lutheran conversation is going on at every table and at the bar, sometimes contentious, but always informative and unabashedly Lutheran. We're only serving Wittenberg Ale. We even have a guy named Norm, so check us out. www.steadfastlutherans.org. We'll save a seat at the bar for you.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a recording of an Easter and Ascension sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Pentecost Sunday, May 27th, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Easter and Ascension sermons. Now, when you make your gift, please indicate whether you want a downloadable version or a CD of these sermons. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us during the Easter season.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest, Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada. We're concluding our series with him on Biblical Archaeology Today, Jewish Burial Traditions. He's author of several books, including his latest, Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. We are giving away a copy of his book free to the listener with the best question or comment on biblical archaeology during this hour. 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or visit our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. We have left a space there for you to leave a question or a comment. Okay, we've talked about the customs themselves. Why was burial, and in particular these forms of burial, why was it important to the Jewish people, Dr. Evans?
Well, you know, we don't know really why burial of the dead was so important to the Jewish people. All we know is that it was, and it always was. It goes back to the earliest times that we can trace. I mean, you know, the fountainhead, the figure, the father of the Jewish people was Abraham. And he went out of his way to find a special place, buy a plot of land, buy a cave for the burial of the famous matriarch, his wife, Sarah. Why that great emphasis? I don't know. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. In Scripture, you have an entire chapter, chapter 23 of Genesis, devoted to the purchase of this cave and the burial of Sarah. And that testifies to its importance. When you get to the end of Genesis, the patriarch Joseph wants to be sure that his bones are taken out of Egypt and brought to the promised land. There you have the practice of collecting the bones, or ossilagium, right there. And so it goes as far back to the beginning. When Jacob hears of the death of his son, his favorite son, Joseph, and his coat of many colors, he grieves over this. And in a vivid retelling by Philo, a first century Jewish writer, he tells of the father just weeping and grieving over the loss of his son. And why? It isn't just that he's dead. Nobody buried him. It's because he's been attacked by an animal, and presumably he's been dismembered, his bones have been scattered, and nobody has had mercy and taken pity and gathered his remains and given them a proper burial. So it really does testify to a long history of attaching huge significance to burial. Josephus bears witness to this, so do the rabbis. It's considered a very pious thing. You observe the Sabbath, you give alms to the poor, and you make sure the dead are decently buried. It's funny how that is. We moderns tend not to think that way, but it was considered a very important moral obligation and an act of piety to bury the dead, especially if you find someone dead lying on the side of the road, a neglected corpse, to see to its proper burial was considered an act of charity and mercy.
Now, it also, you say, had something to do with an attempt to preserve the land itself from defilement. What's going on there?
Yes, and that's explicitly stated, I suspect, in reaction to pagan practices where, for deterrence, corpses of executed people would be left dangling from trees or stakes. But in any case, Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 22 and 23, expressly those verses command that no corpse, and that includes a villain, the most wicked person in the world who has been executed, not be left unburied at the setting of the sun. And so, in other words, the Israelites were not to be like their pagan neighbors. And of course, in Jesus' time, this was a potential conflict with Roman authority, because Romans would execute people, and especially in crucifying people, would leave the corpse hanging on a cross. That was all part of the horror of the deterrence. Not only would the person be on the cross overnight, suffering and in pain and agony, but might live for two or three days and then finally die, and the body would still be just left on the cross to decompose, to be picked apart by birds and dogs and other things. Well, in Israel, that would not be permitted. And during peacetime, the Roman authority acquiesced to Jewish sensitivities, customs, and laws, And that's why the legs of crucified persons would be broken to hasten their death. The body would then be taken down and put in a tomb prior to sundown.
This all, I mean, we should note here, this all comports beautifully with the account that we have of Jesus' own crucifixion and burial, doesn't it?
It certainly does. In fact, in my book, I cite a Jewish archaeologist named Jody Magnus. Jody teaches at the University of North Carolina, and she comments that everything the Gospels say about Jesus' death and burial, everything is in step with archaeology and Jewish law. In other words, there's no tension, no contradiction, nothing that seems strange or at variance with everything that we know.
Let's go to the phones and talk with Herman, who's listening in Illinois. Thanks for waiting on the line, Herman.
Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Evans, at the burial of Jesus at that time, would Jesus be buried in like a wrapped banding type of cloths or cloths to make like a cocoon around the body, or would he be put in a complete single piece of cloth referred to as a shroud?
Great question, Herman. Thank you very much. Dr. Evans.
Well, probably the latter. We can't be certain of that, but I've just been reviewing the evidence relating to that in the four Gospels. And so in the Gospels, you'll hear a reference to a sedona in the singular, which would probably be best translated a shroud or burial shroud. You'll also hear of othnia, which is plural, meaning grave clothes. And so both seem to apply. And so I would understand a shroud that was used, a clean linen shroud, one of the gospel writers specifically notes. And then there'd be other cloths involved in binding it to Jesus' body. It's been surmised there may have been a face cloth that would have basically kept his jaw, his mouth closed. And there may have been, of course, cloths that would have been exterior wrapping around the shroud in order to make, I think the corpse would look like a cocoon in that sense. So that's probably how it was done. For one, we don't have to speculate too much because we actually found an unburied corpse. We have found several, but what was unusual in this case is that the shroud had not completely decomposed. And there actually was some of the scalp still clinging to the skull, which had great importance for genetic reasons and medical reasons. And there was a shroud. So it seems like that's the way it was done. I'm sure there was some variation from case to case.
What then does the archaeological evidence provide for us by way of burial in general in the Roman era, the era we're talking about here?
Well, the evidence would suggest, what the evidence shows is there's variation. The Jewish people did it their own way. The Egyptians tended to do it their way. Greeks and Romans were also different. For one thing, they often practiced cremation, which the Jewish people very rarely did. The Egyptians did embalming, at least for people who I would call upper middle class on up. So we see a lot of variety. We have death portraits or mummy masks in Egypt that you don't find with the Jewish people because they were reluctant to make images. So you see a lot of variety, and you also see differences in economics. And so the poor people often were placed simply in the ground, in which trench-cut graves in the ground, not necessarily in a cave. Or a carved-out tomb, and certainly not a monumental tomb with some sort of superstructure on top. And that's another important thing when we're talking about the evidence of crucifixion. The people least likely to be crucified would be the wealthy and the powerful, the influential. And they're the people who would be buried in the best tombs. Therefore, their bones would be the most likely to survive. And so that's why we have very little crucifixion evidence among the skeletons. We do have some, but not much. People who are most likely to be crucified would be the poor, the uninfluential, the powerless, and they're the people least likely to be buried in a way that would result in their bones being well preserved for us 2,000 years later to study them.
There's a remarkable exception to that kind of dearth of crucifixion evidence in the archaeological record that you talk about, a 1968 discovery of an ossuary with a crucifixion victim. We've got about a minute and a half before our break. Let's start talking about this remarkable set of bones.
Yeah, I'm glad to. In fact, we have the man's name written on the ossuary. His name was Jehohanan. And you're quite right. In fact, because of coins and other indications in the tomb, and we were lucky here, we found the ossuary and its grisly contents intact and undisturbed in a tomb that had not been vandalized or robbed. And, you know, that often is not the case. So here we had the evidence undisturbed, and it was determined that this individual had been crucified, and then a year later his bones had been gathered up and placed in an ossuary. The ossuary itself was then placed in the family tomb. In fact, the name of his father evidently was the same, Jehohanan. And so we have these two men, a father and a son named Jehohanan, one of them crucified and properly buried and placed in the family tomb. And it's dated to the 20s, the late 20s A.D. And, of course, if you know your chronology, gospel chronology, you know who the governor was then. It was none other than Pontius Pilate, who, of course, crucified Jesus of Nazareth.
Well, let's take a break. We'll talk more about what was found in that ossuary in 1968, the crucifixion victim. Stay tuned. Have you ever wanted a concise resource on the history of Christianity from the time of the apostles through today? Well, we have just the book for you. It's titled The Church from Age to Age, A History from Galilee to Global Christianity. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase The Church from Age to Age by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, The Church from Age to Age, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April.
Thank you, Todd, and thanks for everything you do.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, on the value of issues, etc.
You've done so much to teach so many people about the depth of the gospel and to find joy in the Christian life and experience.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, issues, etc. Listen to what you want, when you want, at issuesetc.org.
South Africa,
China,
Germany,
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world? India,
Sweden,
Egypt,
France,
Turkey,
Japan,
Australia,
Canada,
United Kingdom,
Hong Kong,
Austria,
Finland,
Malaysia,
Singapore,
Bulgaria,
Korea,
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines,
Mexico,
Spain,
New Zealand,
Kuwait.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Facebook boy with Down syndrome goes viral.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony list, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Millions of people worldwide use the social networking site Facebook to post pictures or simply muse about their day. Sometimes posts can go viral when they're shared over and over. That's just what one little boy's parents were hoping would happen when they posted his picture with a sign that read, "I may not be perfect, but I'm happy. I am God's handiwork, and I am blessed. I am the 10% of children born with Down syndrome who survived Roe v. Wade." As millions of Facebook users can see, sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words.
Are you pro-life? Then visit our website at sba-list.org and discover how you can make a difference. I'm Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. Thanks for taking a stand.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're giving away a copy of our guest, Dr. Crape Evans' new book, Jesus and His World, the Archaeological Evidence, to the listener with the best question or comment as we conclude our five-part daily series with him on biblical archaeology. Today we're talking about Jewish burial traditions. 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, or leave a question or a comment at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. So what did the bones of this crucifixion victim found in this ossuary in 68, what did they show us?
Well, you know, in this case, it wouldn't have taken Sherlock Holmes to figure out the man had been crucified. When the ossuary was found and the bones were taken out, excavators were stunned to see an 11.5 centimeter long rusty iron spike still embedded in the right heel bone. And it makes you almost want to rub your foot. There it is. And the reason the nail had not been removed was because the tip of it had bent back like a fish hook. And so probably we surmise probably hit a knot in the upright beam. And so when the hammer was pounding away on the nail, it simply bent. And then when it was time to extract it, they couldn't pull it out. So someone took a hatchet and just chopped away some of the wood and dislodged it that way. And so poor old Jehohanan, crucified, now dead, was wrapped and buried in a criminal's tomb with the spike and pieces of wood still clinging to it. And a year later, his grieving family gathered his bones with the spike still in his heel and placed him in an ossuary and then wrote his name on it. And that's what we found in 1968, as you mentioned earlier in the program. And in fact, it's olive wood. It's been identified, the species of the wood, and is still clinging to it, small amounts of this wood still clinging to this iron spike. And so here was a graphic example of a man whose arms were probably tied to the crossbeam, the patibulum, and his feet, his heels, nailed to the upright beam. And, of course, you think about it, it's excruciating.
Mark is listening in his car. He's calling us from Illinois. Mark, thanks for waiting on the line.
Hey, Pastor. I was wondering if it's fair to say, thanks to the work of archaeologists, that the history of liberal criticism is the history of being wrong.
It's an interesting, simple way to put it. Thank you, Mark. What do you think of that, Dr. Evans?
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. In fact, I make a point out of it in the introduction in my book. I talk about what's called biblical minimalism. Biblical minimalism is just the attitude that there's very, very little history in the narratives of the Bible. And so, for example, the minimalists will say there probably wasn't a King David, there probably wasn't a King Solomon, there probably was no Kingdom of Israel, and you know, on it goes. In fact, they'll say that the Old Testament narratives, such as the books of Samuel and Kings, that describe all these things, that these books probably weren't written any earlier than the 4th or 5th century B.C., and so this is just a lot of Robin Hood, King Arthur type fairy tales. Well, the trouble is that archaeology in the last two or three decades just keeps knocking holes in this kind of skepticism. And so we now have very firm evidence that reaches back to 1000 B.C., right back to the time of David, that shows, yeah, he was a real person. Yes, there was a kingdom in Jerusalem that reached as far north as today's southern Lebanon. And yes, there were the scribal skills necessary to write these accounts down as far back as the 9th and 10th centuries B.C. So Mark's question, you know, I think it's a good question, and the same thing has related also to the Gospels. If we now fast forward to the New Testament period of time, the ongoing archaeology shows again and again that the Gospel writers actually knew what they were talking about real people, real places, real events. And so I look at it as, well, we've excavated about 5% of the biblical places. Each excavation site is only 5 to 10% complete. So when you add that up, it's a tiny fraction of all that there is to uncover. And if so far, in the last 100 years or so, We have vindicated Old Testament and New Testament stories to such a degree. What will happen when we continue to excavate? So I think Mark's question, he's put it the right way. Archaeology, the history of it, ends up writing the history of the failure and the wrongheadedness of much of skepticism.
Another thing I'd like to note about that particular crucifixion victim that was found in 68 is that his legs were broken, although it's difficult, you say, to determine whether they were broken before or after death. That may be impossible to determine on such ancient remains. What are your thoughts there?
Well, yes, I lean toward very cautiously toward the idea that they probably were broken to hasten his death. What complicates things is that Jehohanan's ossuary contains several skeletons. And so, unfortunately, we're not entirely sure whose bones, or whose bones. And so there's just a little bit of confusion on that. And because of the great age of the bones, it's not easy to tell if a bone was broken at the time that the person was hanging on the cross, or the bones got broken later, long after the skeleton had formed as a skeleton. So it's difficult to say, and so we just can't be dogmatic on that point.
Why do you think it is that we have relatively few examples of either crucifixion victims found, remains found, or general execution victims found at this time?
Well, number one, the bones are very old. And so the small, delicate bones, the bones of the hands, the wrists, the bones of the feet, the tarsals, metatarsals, ankle bones, and so on, these bones do not survive very well, and they're highly degraded. It tends to be the big bones and the long bones. And those bones, of course, rarely give any evidence of crucifixion or trauma. And so in my book, I say Jehohanan's skeleton with the spike in his right heel, that was a real fluke. I mean, that was just a lucky break. And the only reason we knew the man had been crucified was because there was the spike. They had been unable to get it out of his heel. Had they managed to get it out of his heel, I doubt if we would have known that he had been crucified. And so that's why I say in my book, we don't know for a fact that we have found only one crucified man. We may have recovered a dozen, and we just don't know it because the skeletal remains are in such poor shape, you just can't determine it. The other thing, too, is that not every crucified victim was nailed to the cross. They were beaten savagely, and then they were tied to a cross. And so there'd be no evidence of crucifixion trauma in that case. And then, as I said earlier in the program, the most likely victims of crucifixion, the poor and the powerless, they're the ones who are buried in the simplest way, usually in the ground, and therefore their bones are the least likely to survive and give us any helpful evidence. The people whose bones do survive rather well, and bones that we therefore now can study, they're the people who were wealthy and powerful and least likely to suffer crucifixion.
There are objections raised by skeptics with regard to the biblical account that it would have been highly unlikely, if not just completely implausible, for Jesus to have been buried as he was after his crucifixion, given how the Romans would have treated crucifixion victims after death. What do you say to that?
Well, I think people who raise that objection just aren't well acquainted with the facts, either with the archaeology or the Jewish customs of burial. What happens is, and I know some of the authors you probably have in mind, they'll say something like, well, the Romans didn't care. Well, I know that. The Romans didn't care. If the Jewish people had said, we don't mind having corpses of crucified people hanging on crosses for days and weeks on end, the Romans would have been quite content to leave the grisly remains unburied and so forth. But the Jewish people did care. And it wasn't simply pity for the crucifixion victims themselves and their families. The main thing was what that passage of Scripture that got mentioned at the top of the program, Deuteronomy 21, the main concern was the sanctity of the land. And we see that not just in Scripture, but in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, where they envision a great battle when the Roman armies will be slaughtered. And it's so interesting. What happens? Well, the priests, of course, immediately come out and start telling everybody how to get rid of these corpses so the land won't be defiled. And so, you know, it's, most of us wouldn't think about that. You know, it's a great eschatological battle. Satan and his allies are defeated. Everybody's celebrating. But meanwhile, the priests are running around cleaning up the land, getting rid of the defiling bodies of the defeated enemy. And so that very much reflects the reality in Jesus' day. And so the priests condemn Jesus to death. And according to Jewish law and tradition, the priests were to see to it that this person that they've condemned to death gets properly buried. Not in honor, not with any sorrow, no lamentation, but just gets properly buried. And according to Jewish rabbinical works, there were tombs set aside for this exact purpose under the control of the Sanhedrin, where the executed were properly buried. A year later, their bones could be gathered up by family members and be taken to their own family tombs.
We'll take a break when we come back 10 more minutes in our series with Dr. Craig Evans on biblical archaeology, giving away a copy of his book called Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-I-E.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Pastor Todd, I downloaded your Issues, Etc. app for my Android phone, and I listen to it while I'm on the treadmill.
You can listen to Issues, Etc. live or on demand with the new Issues, Etc. Android or iPhone app. You can download these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. in the palm of your hand. Download an app today.
My new Adam really enjoys the app while I'm on the treadmill.
Delivering apologetics artillery right on target. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does your church need a backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues, Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues, Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. We're talking biblical archaeology, the final in our daily series with him this week, a little bit on Jewish burial traditions. Dr. Evans, a quick question before we go to some of our listeners' questions. How solid do you think the various locations for Jesus' own tomb archaeologically are?
Well, that's a great question. I'm asked that every time we go to Israel and visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I would say the odds in favor of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre as resting on the actual place where Jesus was crucified, and probably very nearby the tomb where his body was laid for the weekend, I think the odds are better than 50-50 that the church is in the right place. And I say that because of this. It's the way the tomb was discovered as a slight against Jews and Christians after the great Bar Kokhba revolt at the beginning of the 2nd century A.D. Emperor Hadrian and his successors demolished a number of sacred sites, and the sacred tomb, which we know from historical records Christians visited, we don't know precisely where, but in that vicinity, it was then filled over with landfill, and on top of it, a pagan shrine was built. Well, 200 years later, the Roman Empire has been converted, and so Emperor Constantine's mother, Queen Helen, visits the area, and of course, she's checking out holy sites. Now, I have no doubt some of the holy sites that the locals pointed out to her were based on legend and not very credible. But when she came to Jerusalem looking for where Jesus had been crucified and where he had been buried, the locals said, oh, right there underneath this pagan shrine. And so, you know, this shrine had been there for 200 years. And so the shrine was pulled down, the ground was unearthed, and they dug down, and guess what they found? First century, a complex of first century tombs. And then, of course, she gave orders that the Church of the Holy Sepulchre be built atop it. So it strikes me as either they were remarkably lucky in pointing to a spot and just sheer guesswork, and they got it right, or it's more likely that there was this living village memory that had lasted for 300 years that everybody knew that was the place. And so I would have to say, yeah, it's probably better than 50-50, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Now, we can't be precise and go there because there's more than one tomb. It was a complex. But it probably is. You know, if when you're standing inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you're probably within a stone's throw of the actual place where it happened.
A couple of general questions from our listeners. This one comes from Michael in Strasburg, Illinois. He says, one of the most important things in intellectual pursuits is the ability to be honest about the weakness, vulnerabilities, and limitations of your position. What archaeological find has been the most challenging to our traditional understanding of Scripture? Or, to put it another way, what archaeological find has led to the greatest correction of a misunderstanding of a text of Scripture? That's a great question, by the way.
Yeah, I don't want to shoot from the hip and just take a guess at it, so I'm not going to answer it precisely. I'm going to simply say in a vague way, I'm not aware of anything with respect to the New Testament Gospels where, you know, we believe something because the Gospel said something, and then along comes an archaeological discovery that shows it's wrong. There's a series of mistakes that we've made about where we think something is, like the pool of Bethsaida is a good example of that. We had it the wrong place for a long time, the pool of Siloam, and then only in the last few years have we found a pool in a different location, and we realize, oh, I think we now know where it is. So there have been those kinds of things, but it had more to do with our own ignorance as we grope go about archaeology, trying to find the right locations and then interpret what we find correctly. I think that would be true of some of the Old Testament studies, too. So what, in my experience, the discoveries have tended to correct sometimes either skepticism or where we're confident that we know, oh, this must be the case, this must be where this happened, or this must be such and such a village. And then we make a discovery, and then, oops, we realize we were wrong. So, like right now, we're not real sure where Arimathea used to be. We're not real sure where Emmaus used to be, the two men on the road to Emmaus. So there's those kinds of things, and so then we identify a place, and we think, that's probably it. And then you don't know, an archaeological discovery might come along and force us to shift our view and say, no, it can't be that place, it must be this other one over here. But I'm not aware of any archaeological discovery that's been made that shows that something taught or something claimed in the Bible is just flat out right wrong.
This one comes from Emily in Papillon, Nebraska. She says, I wonder if Dr. Evans could recommend any resources for young aspiring archaeologists. I'm sure it's a field that needs more men and women in it. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I can. In fact, I do. Toward the back of the book, I'm flipping right now toward it. Todd, if you have the book there too, you'll see it starts on page 175. It's called Suggestions for Further Reading. And I list about, 20 or 25 books. I'm not going to read off the titles, but there they are on pages 175, 176. Some of these are a little bit technical, but most of them are designed for general readers. And then on the bottom of the page, on to the next page, I list the names of some journals, magazines. Some of them are technical, but some of them are pretty light reading and fun to read, like the Biblical Archaeology Review. So I'll put in a plug for BAR, Biblical Archaeology Review, not only because it's easy to follow along with archaeological discoveries and discussions, but it also provides information about various digs somebody can get involved in. And I think that's the best answer to the question, and that's volunteer for a dig, go to Israel for 6 or 8 weeks or something like that this summer or next summer, go to a place like Bethsaida, or go to Sepphoris, or any one of Cana of Galilee is another place. Go there, get involved in a dig, find out what goes on, see what's happening. You'll get to know the archaeologists, so you'll get some free tours. You'll learn tons of stuff, and you'll get that question answered. You'll find out about a lot of good books and magazines you can read as a neophyte and really, really grow in the field.
A quick call from Michael, who is listening to Issues Etc. on the Issues Etc. Android app in Maryland. Michael, welcome.
Hi. Question. You talked about how they buried the middle class, the poor, and the criminals. What did they do for the disease, such as the people who had leprosy, who were ostracized because of the contagiousness of the illness?
That's a great question. It's one that Dr. Evans actually deals with in the book.
Well, they're treated the same way, because a person who is dead, a corpse in other words, is considered unclean, just as a leper is too. And so if a leper dies, then the leper's body is prepared for burial, and just the same way as I described. Now, here's the interesting thing. We actually know that. I referred earlier in the program to the shroud. It's called the shroud tomb. We actually found a skeleton whose bones had not been gathered up and placed in a box, a skeleton still laying out on a ledge, covered in a shroud, and there's some of his scalp was still attached to his skull. Now, that was most unusual. So what we did was we did DNA testing and determined that he, in fact, was a blood relative of other people in the tomb. But what we discovered was he died from leprosy. So we actually have an example of it. What that proved was that leprosy, the Hansen's disease, actually existed in the first century. That's another example where someone had one time said, a skeptic, well, the Bible, of course, is wrong. Hansen's disease did not appear in the Middle East till the 3rd or 4th century A.D. Well, it turns out, no, actually it was present in the time of Jesus and probably earlier, just as the Bible all along said. So here we actually found someone with leprosy. He had died probably from tuberculosis, which often happens to people suffering with leprosy. And he was buried in the usual way, his body washed, wrapped, perfumed, laid out in a tomb. But for whatever reason, probably because of the Jewish rebellion in 66, his bones were not gathered a year later and placed in a box.
With only about 30 seconds here, Dr. Evans, let's kind of begin where we ended with only 30 seconds. A word of caution about getting really excited about the latest archaeological discovery as we read about it popularly in the press. About 30
seconds. Yes, that's right. That's a great warning. Beware. People will make sensational claims about the Talpia tomb or the Patio tomb, or there's some new huge theory that proves something. Take it with a grain of salt. Wait for the archaeologists to weigh in who really know what they're talking about it. Give it time for it to settle and for it to be properly analyzed.
Dr. Craig Evans is Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada. He's author of several books, including his latest publication titled Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. Dr. Evans, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're most welcome. It was my pleasure.
Emily, in Papillon, Nebraska, if you would send us your mailing address, talk back, at issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. We will send you a copy of Jesus and His World, the Archaeological Evidence. Thanks for all your questions and your comments. By the way, you can purchase Jesus and His World at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. We have the evidence. It continues to come in. I don't think the vector of this evidence is going to change, do you? That as we continue to dig and discover things in and around the place where Jesus conducted His ministry, where He was born, where He lived, where He died, where He rose again, well, I don't think we're going to find anything that's going to overturn now the mountain of evidence that we're dealing with real history, that we're dealing with a real live Savior, one who not only did, was conceived there at a certain point, was born there, did live there and work there, conduct His ministry, preach, heal, raise the dead, but was given as the sacrifice for the sins of all the world and raised again Himself as the vindication of that sacrifice. We're dealing with a real Jesus, a real Savior. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you Monday. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Augsburg Lutheran, Shawnee, Kansas. Peace Lutheran, Fresno, California. Trinity Lutheran, Casper, Wyoming. Memorial Lutheran, Houston, Texas. Trinity Lutheran, Gillette, Wyoming. Our Savior Lutheran, Ridgecrest, California. St. Mary's Lutheran, Des Moines, Iowa. Redeemer Lutheran, Kakabeka Falls, Ontario, Canada. St. Jacoby Lutheran, Shawano, Wisconsin. And St. John's Lutheran, North Prairie, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300.